Our podcast today is brought to you by our friends over at Dying Breed Music. If you are into vintage flat-top guitars from the golden era, Dying Breed is your store. Right now, they have a 1934 Gibson Southern Jumbo, a 1934 Martin 00018 long scale that, get this, has only had one owner since it's left Nazareth. Completely original down to its bar frets. A very cool guitar. They have a 1938 Martin D18 with a 1¾-inch nut, and on, so many other cool gems from the golden era. Lane gets a lot of these guitars through his competitive consignment program, so if by any chance you are sitting on some cool guitars that you want to part ways with, you should definitely give him a call over at 870-818-3434. And if you're in the market to buy guitars, check out his entire inventory at dyingbreedguitars.com or via his GBase page. And if you do reach out to him, please tell him the Fretboard Journal podcast sent you. Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I am Jason Verlinde, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal. And as always, that is John Rauhouse playing in the background. I am talking to you from our Seattle, Washington headquarters. And I have to admit, I am running on fumes. My family got a new puppy about a week ago, and I have not been getting a ton of sleep thanks to said puppy. It is a very cute dog. I know a lot of you have seen pictures of it on social media, but this has been an adjustment. I forgot how hard it is to have a young dog in your household. Nevertheless, the show must go on, and I have a couple of quick announcements, and then we'll get to the interview. Our 42nd issue of the Fretboard Journal is out now. I know a bunch of you subscribers have already been receiving it. If you haven't yet, it is in the hands of the USPS and should be showing up any day now. I know a bunch of folks have been buying Fretboard Journal subscriptions for Father's Day gifts, which is awesome. Fretboard Journal 42 has I'm With Her, the Americana supergroup on the cover. Afi O'Donovan, Sarah Watkins, and Sarah Jarosz comprise that band. That is our second black and white cover in our 42-issue history. Can you name the very first black and white cover we did? It was John Hartford and Fretboard Journal 4. What else is in that issue? A mammoth feature on Big Sandy and his Fly Right Boys, one of my favorite rockabilly bands. And super deep dive into the arcane world of vintage Martin minutia with Mark Stepman of Folkway Music and TJ Thompson. And my interview with Andy Powers of Taylor Guitars is in that issue, plus a lot more. If you want to subscribe to the magazine and get a copy of that, you still can. You can just go to fretboardjournal.com. You can even use the coupon code podcast, and I will take $5 off of your order, and we will mail that little magazine off to you very quickly. The other big news around these parts is we've announced our first ever Fretboard Journal Electric Annual. That is a standalone book / magazine, whatever you want to call it, dedicated to the world of electric guitar makers and players. We have been busy gathering a ton of stories for that issue. It's going to be mailing out in early August. And if you want to reserve your copy, the only way to do it right now is to go to fretboardjournal.com and you can pre-order a copy and we will mail it to you. This isn't going to be a magazine that you're going to find at 7-Eleven. It's not going to be a magazine that you'll even find at Guitar Center. We are going to be distributing it to select dealers as well as all of the people who buy it directly from us, just because we hate waste. So we want it to go to people who will actually read it as opposed to dusty shelves where it may never see the light of day. So go to fretboardjournal.com if you want to reserve a copy, and we will make sure you get one. And I guess because of that, we've had a lot of electric guitars on the brain lately, and that is the reason that I am talking to today's guest, John Sullivan, also known as Sully of Sully Guitars. If you don't know about Sully, his story is truly amazing. You're going to hear all sorts of names that you never hear in the pages of the Fretboard Journal nor on this podcast, but they are all amazing names in terms of builders and musicians, and we don't really cover the heavy metal and hard rock world too much, but Sully's been in that world, but he also builds incredibly cool looking guitars. He can talk very eloquently about the craft of luthery, as you will hear, and he's just got kind of the wildest story in terms of how he became a guitar maker. And so I wanted to talk to him. I think you will love it. I certainly did. I can't wait to share that with you. So we will do that right now. Here is my talk with Sully of Sully's Guitars. I do hope you enjoy it. Hello, Sully. How are you?
I'm delightful. Thank you for asking. How are you today?
I'm good. So we're going to do this little podcast with you. And I have a feeling half of the audience listening to this, or half of the potential audience, will know literally everything about your life imaginable, because you are definitely one of the rare individuals who shares a lot about his background and your knowledge on online and podcasts and stuff. And then the other half won't know anything about you. And so let's get the primer on John Sully Sullivan. And where did you grow up?
I grew up at a very young age in the Chicago suburbs. I would actually, just going back momentarily, I would probably wager that the overwhelming majority is probably saying, who is this guy? He's this, why do I care? No, I don't know if I do yet. So bear with us, at least. Give us that. And, by the time this is ended, then, you might feel better about going, no, I was right. But I'm a faithful listener to the podcast, so I'm going to do Jason a solid, and I'm going to get through this.
Our followers are very patient. You're in good hands. We're a sensitive bunch.
That's good to know. Well, thank you. I grew up like Chicago suburbs in the 80s. I think I could be best categorized as a hair metal kid. I think many would probably say that is still very true of me. But okay. Yeah.
And you grew up like in suburbs?
I did, yeah. I think like with any kind of city, when you move out of it and you say, oh, where are you from? Well, I'm from, I grew up in Wheaton, Illinois. People say, it's like, yeah. Chicago. Yeah, I lived right on the top of the Sears Tower, and it was very cold and very windy. I grew up in what's known as DuPage County, which is probably about 30 miles west of the city. What's funny is that, or I guess, I don't know if it's funny, but coincidentally, a fine builder by the name of Frank Falbo grew up in a town called Glen Ellen, which was right next door. So we probably, passed each other riding bikes one day.
Okay. And you had, you were like a metal kid. You had the denim jacket with the patches and the Sharpie stuff, or what was your deal?
Sure. Yeah. Okay. Sure. I was probably a mix of all of those things. When I saw Kiss in the late 70s. I mean, in magazines and stuff. And, for many people, and they've got those moments, those life altering moments. I was with my mom in a grocery store, and I saw a copy of 16 magazine on the newsstand in the grocery store. And, there's Kiss, and I had known that Kiss was a thing that the big kids listened to. Yeah. And I grabbed the magazine, and there's Scott Baio and Leif Garrett, and I'm just kind of flipping through, and I see Kiss, and I see pictures of Ace with guitar with smoke pouring out of his guitar. And for a kid that was into superheroes, to see this it was kind of blew my mind, because it was like they were larger than life and nobody knew what they looked like. And Ace looked really cool, and smoke pouring out of his guitar, and girls liked them, and oh, I like all of those things. So I stole my sister's acoustic guitar, and I had an album called Chipmunk Punk, and it had Seek This Out. This is a solid record by the Chipmunks. It's got covers of Refugee by Tom Petty. It's got My Sharona, You May Be Right by Billy Joel. And anyway, so I taught myself how to play My Sharona as best as I could, and it's been kind of downhill from then. Growing up, jean jackets and Motley Crue patches, and drawing all over leather jackets with paint markers. And I was blessed with very voluminous hair to begin with. So I was a natural for the extra super hold white can of Aquanet.
Nice.
Yeah. I joined my first band when I was probably about 14. And I had a BC Rich Warlock that didn't actually have a Kaler, so that was a rare find at that time.
Yeah.
And, you know, also did like my first pickup swap, like on that guitar too, when I was, you know, it was at band practice and my bridge pickup went out, and I just happened to have, like you do when you're 15, a DiMarzio Super Distortion. So I got on my bike and rode home and I grabbed the pickup back, and I swapped the pickup out, in my drummer Eric Bruck's basement, with the soldering iron was hanging from, you know, in the basement, there was, you know, like light bulbs that had like outlets in them. So yeah. I had the soldering iron that was just swinging from the ceiling, you know, just, you know, it was perfect. And I still do that. I still do it that way today. No, that's not true.
Okay. They just had a soldering iron for dad's projects or something.
You know, I think I had it. I had got a Les Paul kit for, Christmas earlier that year. And that's, you know, I got the pickups, my aunt and uncle got the pickups for it. And I had some tools. It was probably my stepdad's or something. I don't know how I actually had a soldering iron, but, I did. And so I just followed the directions and I'm like, oh, well, this isn't that hard.
Nice.
But, yeah, good times.
And you just, it sounds like you just wanted to tinker with guitars for a while. Like a Les Paul kit is not, for the faint of heart necessarily as a teenager.
Yeah, it was, you know, I always wanted a Les Paul, you know, because of Ace Frehley, and my stepdad had, he had, when Gibson came out with the studio, and like right away, like initially came out with the studio, it was a somewhat different looking guitar than it is now, in that it had dot inlays, and it had a bound fretboard, and the body was bound, and he had a 61 maybe Les Paul when they were just the SG style. It was a junior, and he traded that in, and I'm like, oh, okay. He traded that in for a Les Paul studio, and oh man, I wanted that guitar so bad. And whenever he would be at work, I would sneak in and play his guitar. And I found out that a local music store was selling these Les Paul kits. So I begged and begged and begged, and I got it for Christmas, and it was still, like, to this day, like one of the greatest Christmases ever. But so we glued the neck in and initially painted it like a cherry red using spray cans, and I wound up painting it black, and then I took it to this local shop near me. At the time was called it was Volano's Music. It was in Villa Park, Illinois, just on Roosevelt Road, near where the Guitar Center is now, for those of you listening in the Villa Park area. So Dave, you know where I'm talking about. Hey, how'd you know my name's Dave? it was over by there. And so I took it to this place, Villano's Music, because the guy that did repairs, he was the cool guy that you took lessons from. He taught guitar lessons and did repair work. And he was, you know, like all the kids that I went to school with at the time that were learning how to play, you know, would take lessons from Steve, and Steve would also build parts guitars. And Steve, like, grew up with Glenn Tipton from Judas Priest. So, like, Steve was like,
he's the cool guy.
Yeah. Steve was awesome. So I took this guitar in, and, you know, and I said, well, you know, I didn't know how to do anything else. You know, I just painted the thing and put the pickups in. And it was kind of, you know, here, sir, can you finish this for me? And he's like, you built this? I'm like, mm-hmm. Boy, later did I find out what building really actually means. But, you know, I glued the neck in and painted it. Turns out the neck was twisted, and my world was turned upside down at that day. But I used to Steve later in about a year or so, like, opened up his own guitar store, and it was within walking distance to my house, and so I used to just hang out there like a stray cat, and all through, you know, my teenage years, I would either, you know, ditch school and hang out there, or just hang out there. And they were always really nice to me, and they're still open in Lombard, Illinois. And you know, I would watch Steve do repairs and stuff, and ask him questions. And he would also, you know, he would always tell me what he was doing in a manner that, like, as if I understood. I had no idea whatever he was talking about. So I just kind of picked this up, and, you know, just kind of growing up at that time, I think everybody had custom guitars. So when I didn't actually become a rock star, I, you know, kind of went into that kind of building thing. Cause that was always something that I also just kind of did, you know, growing up too. So that's, and it kind of spun out of control, and here we are listening to me yammer on about
yeah.
that.
Well, I'm impressed. I was probably trying to get the high score at Dig Dug or something at that time. So, with nary any intentions of building anything, but,
sure.
What you graduate, I'm assuming you graduated high school.
Sure, we'll say that.
All right. And then where did you go?
I went to Hollywood, California soon after. I moved out to Hollywood with my band when I was like 18. And just would have been like summer, September or so of 1990. Okay. Stayed there for a couple of years, moved back to Chicago, and
we can't just gloss over Hollywood. Like, what are we talking, like the whiskey? Where are you playing? What are you doing? What's the name of this band?
So I was in a band called Hell's Orphans, which was as uplifting and fun as it sounds. And but I was too young to get in anywhere. I would kind of like, you know, I moved out there with my band, and we were a bass player short of being able to play out. And we thought, well, you know, we'll just find a bass player out there. How hard can it be? You know, as bands tend to do, especially when you move across country, some people freak out and go, I think I'm going to go back over here now.
Yeah.
And so, you know, most people move back. I stayed for a few years, and kind of instead of becoming a rock star, I got to hang out with a few of them. You know, it was kind of a challenge because, you know, I was, you know, I was 20 at my oldest when I was there. And, you know, yeah, sure, you can get in to places underage if you're of the female persuasion.
Yeah.
If you're just some, you know, gangly 6'3" kid with huge hair and leather pants, you know, nobody really cares and wants you to hang around. So I hung out in at the time on the Sunset Strip, which was a lot of fun. And you know, on the weekends, right by the whiskey on, I think that's San Vicente and Sunset, they would block the street off. The street would be closed on Friday night, Saturday night. And it was just people in bands walking up and down the strip, putting up flyers. And there was just this, you know, from like the whiskey up until the Rainbow. And just after the Rainbow was a club called Gazzari's. And that was just kind of, you know, Mecca at that time. And, it was very much a scene. So even if you didn't go into a club, you're walking up and down the strip and there's just tons of people. And you know, I used to hang out in the parking lot of the Rainbow, which was, you know, it was one of those places that a lot of people hung out in. And I saw David Lee Roth and David Bowie, and I had the misfortune of meeting Gene Simmons for the first time there. And, it was really pretty cool.
Sounds like it was like a Bourbon Street vibe with just people pouring out in the streets.
Yes, yes, okay. Yes. Absolutely. With a lot more, leather and hair dye.
And actual bourbon, probably.
Actual bourbon. you know, me and, we had this friend, Joey, would bring a bottle of vodka, and we'd walk down to this AMPM, which is a gas station convenience store, which sure. It's still there on the corner of Clark and San Vicente. And we would go and get, you know, kind of like a big gulp, kind of like a huge cup, and, you know, pour it, you know, with a little bit of Sprite or whatever, and then just fill it full of vodka and just kind of walk up and down the street. So it was, that's kind of what we did. And, you know, it just, it was a little community of misfits. And in the times I have been back, you know, I'm kind of out there, over the past few years, it seems like about every 6 months. And there have been a couple of times when I've gone through Hollywood to like the places I used to live and see those neighborhoods. And, some of it is changed. Some of those places are still there. It is interesting to see that through a different set of eyes now, since it's, you know, it was 25, 6, 7 years ago.
Sure.
Yeah, yeah.
So how are you making a living for these 2 years?
You know. you know, I mean, you just kind of stay with friends and crash on couches and meet people who might be sympathetic to your plight and might, you know, have a couch you can crash on for a while. It was a very nomadic lifestyle. We were in hotels for a long time, just kind of just crashing with people. And, you know, I remember there was a time when we were staying with a friend in North Hollywood for 3 weeks in their house, and we had a 10-pound bag of potatoes to eat. And there are only so many ways you can cut up potatoes, but it's just kind of.
I interestingly enough, yeah, just went on an all potato diet for 2 weeks, so I know this story. Yeah, it was great. It changed my life, actually. But yeah,
all starch with Jason.
Yeah, it was good. Lost a bunch of weight. Felt good.
Right.
So you, this entire time you're in Hollywood, in addition to being kind of a metal fan, was the dream of like the band's eventually going to formulate or I'll find some new band, was that there the whole time?
Yeah. Okay. It was one of those things where, you know, I'll find people to play with. And, you know, it was a bit of a challenge, and you know, like you do when you're a well-adjusted 19 and 20-year-old, you get in a fantastically codependent relationship, you might become a parent. So and then that you know, shifted things, and we moved back to Chicago, and
you became a parent. Okay.
Yeah, super great idea. Highly recommended.
Hey, your kid could be listening to this.
Oh, well, I'll let him know. He's a great kid, and I'm super proud of him. And, you know, I went from being out in Los Angeles and doing all that. And by the time I was 22, I was, you know, a single parent with sole custody. So he's very well aware of these sorts of these stories.
You probably have a rapport that few fathers and sons do.
Perhaps.
So you get back to Illinois, and what's the plan besides trying to figure out how to raise a kid?
That was really much the plan. And, you know, and then still trying to, you know, I went back and started playing with some of the guys that I was in bands with, but it was, you know, a lot of it just kind of became, I would just write a lot of music. And when my son was sleeping, you know, I would just record, you know, stuff with drum machines and four tracks you know, just try and figure things out. But it was never one of those things where I would stop playing guitar. That I couldn't, and to this day, I still can't really fathom. I may not play guitar as much as I used to, but, you know, they're always there, you know?
Yeah.
And it just kind of segued into, I just got more into, you know, working on my own guitars and, in that sort of thing. And, maybe in like 2001 or so, I started making, you know, my own parts guitars, you know, like Steve did when I was a teenager. And, you know, I'd go and see them at Park Avenue Music and check in and still maintain that relationship. And whenever I'm in Chicago, I'll still, you know, stop by the store and say hello and catch up. And it's always great. So it eventually just, you know, I started building parts guitars, prefab bodies and necks, and then just slowly, you know, made the transition to doing things from scratch, which was quite a learning experience, and it still is to this day, because I had, you know, zero woodworking background. Mm-hmm. I just did a lot of reading, a lot of you know, watching videos and you know, participating on various forums and kind of build a little community and a network of people, and you know, you eventually kind of get at it. And I still remember the first time I you know, powered a router on with a bit in it, and it was just, oh, this could end poorly. This could really end poorly. And, you know, a lot of builders that I know that had woodworking backgrounds probably approach things different than I do because of their, you know, background. They might use things like chisels and scrapers and things like that more than I ever have or will. I kind of subscribe to the mentality of, you know, you start where you are and use what you have and do what you can. And I got pretty far with a Craigslist bandsaw and a desktop jointer and a drill press and you know, you can in a couple of routers, you can get a lot done with that.
And are you having to hold down a day job to keep the roof over your head?
At this time, no. I've been building full time for 4.5 years now.
Okay.
Yeah. So I made the jump.
So it was first just parts casters or parts guitars.
Yeah.
Or,
yeah. 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 And you know, and then once I started, you know, building my own bodies and then doing my own paint, and that it was a discipline unto itself, and you know, and then eventually, you know, you post enough pictures on the internet, someone's going to say, "Oh, hey, would you build me one?" And then you're faced with that crossroads of, "Whoa, geez, what do I do here?" And you know, then you kind of price things accordingly. And yeah, you know, I recommend don't sell your early stuff, kids. And you know, don't build one guitar and start a guitar company. But because those things will surface every now and again. And I probably started, you know, with doing, you know, moving to doing my own bodies in like 2004, 2005 or so, and then it just kind of built over time from there. And I started doing teaching classes as well, just out of the garage, and just basic, you know, kind of like, you want to build a body, come on over on a Friday, on a Saturday and Sunday, and you know, you'll leave with the body that will accommodate like a Fender spec, you know, neck or something like that. So you could get like a Warmoth neck and slap it on, and you know, you'll be good to go. Went from, you know, offering a body class and then like a 3-day neck class. And, you know, I ran into, this was while I was, you know, towards the end of a day job, and I got to this point where a lot of people would say, you know, I really want to take a class, but if I'm going to come out there from where I live, because most people would travel, which was, you know, kind of like, wow. If I'm going to come out and do that, I want to actually like build a complete, you know, body and a neck, and, you know, I want to build a guitar, and, you know, perfectly logical.
Yeah.
But it was one of those things where, you know, I didn't have, you know, in order for me to do that, I would have to have the vacation time at the day job to support it. So
what was the day job?
At my last day job, I worked for a cellular company, like managing their, quality assurance and training department.
Okay.
So most of my day jobs were, you know, like call center management, generally within like the wireless field of, so I've, you know, worked for AT&T and, when Singular was around, and, T-Mobile, and I worked for some software companies. so it got to the point where, I thought to myself, you know, here's how much, you know, just kind of figured out, okay, so if I have these classes on a regular basis, how much, you know, what are the dollars and cents, what's the profit? And I know that's not very romantic, but you know, what's the profit, and how can I schedule this? And so I thought, well, okay, so let me just go ahead and clear, you know, I'll just post some dates and say, okay, so those of you that wanted to, you know, do a complete guitar class, you know, here, I'm scheduling these weeks, and I would do a couple, you know, for, you know, a couple, in a month. And, with the thought of, if these things sell, and sell out, I'm going to have to quit my day job in order to have these classes. And, you know, somewhat impulsive, but it was also one of those things where I had been building for a little while. It had been, you know, a few years by now, because this is, you know, we're talking 2014. At that time, my custom order books, which as they still are now, were such that you can't really get a whole bunch of stuff turned around quickly. So it was one of these things where it was just kind of, you know, keep your day job until you absolutely have to get rid of it. And so that's what I did. So I put these dates up, and they were all pretty much claimed within about 24 hours, and all the deposits were there in about 72. And, you know, so then it was, okay, so October 1st, 2014, that's it. I'm done. I'm out. I'm working for myself. I burned the khakis, and I haven't looked back. So It's been a process. I'm very fortunate in that Mrs. Sully has always kind of had her own business, and she's always worked for herself. So she was, you know, has always been, yeah, it's going to be fine. You're good. You know, it's going to be, yeah, it'll be, you know, it's going to be fine.
Yeah.
It's going to be a little up and a little down, but yeah, it'll be fine. All good. Knock yourself out. Like, oh, cool.
And who, in terms of your own custom guitars, like, who were the builders that you looked up to that you really?
Grover Jackson. That's it.
Okay. end of podcast.
Yeah. Thanks, everybody. yes, absolutely. So, you know, as growing up, always loved Jacksons. And for me, it started with Randy Rhoads. But I also. And I know that Jackson guitars get a pointy hair metal butt rock connotation to them. But I would like to point out, kids, that the earliest customers of Charvel Jackson and Jackson Charvel Manufacturing were guys like Billy Gibbons, guys like David Gilmour, who had a Charvel neck on that black Strat of his that everybody loves so much, had a Fender logo on it, but... You know, those were Charvel necks for a while, at least. Jeff Beck had a couple of soloists and still has those two soloists to this day. You know, and well, I remember seeing Jeff Beck on the cover of, I want to say it was probably Musician Magazine. No, it was Guitar World when he had the Tina Turner soloist on there. And it was the this burgundy pink metallic soloist. And it's got Tina Turner's name like carved into it. And I remember reading the story. I'm like, man, that's so rad. And all the bands that I was listening to at the time, you know, they played Jackson guitars like Rat and, you know, obviously Randy Rhoads. And then Jakey Lee was a Charvel guy. And, you know, Steve Vai, before he went to Ibanez, he had Jacksons. He had a bunch of them. And that was, to me, like the cool hot rod custom, you know, rad looking guitars. And I think, you know, that was, it was so inspirational to me. And like, you know, Randy Rhoads's white, original Rhoads V, which is a prototype with, right, with the pinstripes. That guitar is hands down my favorite guitar in the world. And a lot of, you know, a lot of the inspiration of why I do what I do, was, you know, because it was one of these things where it's like you could come up with a really cool design that, you know, they're still making them now, and it's probably their most popular model still. It's withstood the test of time, and it isn't necessarily associated only to Randy Rhoads. There are plenty of guys that play those guitars. You know, Grover introduced, you know, the compound radius. The super switch, that was something that came out of Jackson. He also, you know, eventually started making his own pickups. He told me that was because he couldn't get OEM pricing out of Duncan, so they started making their own. Mm-hmm. And it was very inspirational to me. And you know, I along with all of the pictures of the guys that I had on my walls, I had a copy of this Jackson Charvel ad, and it had Grover's picture on it, and it said, "We don't pay him; they just play him." And it was, you know, I'm like, "Oh, that's Grover Jackson. That's so, you know, so cool." And he was just as important to me as the guitars, you know, and the guys that I looked up to. And you know, to me, you know, my idea of like a perfect vintage guitar for me is like an 83, 84, 85 Rhoads. That's what kind of gets me all excited. I mean, I can definitely appreciate an old Les Paul, but I don't want to play one. Same thing with like a Strat. My favorite Strats are like the two color, like 57 bursts, but I can't play those necks.
Yeah.
And I'm also, I would like to say, you know, I'm not one of those guys, who are, so picky, and it's like, oh, well, I can't play a guitar with that gauge strings on it, or I can't play a red guitar because I won't be able to fret. I mean, I'm not that guy, but it's, you know, you give me,
we all know like that.
No. And there's never anything like that on the internet. But I mean, you know what it's like. You pick up a guitar and it's like, either that neck is like, all right, cool. Or it's like, nope. Yeah. And for me, it's, you know, I've never had a Fender because like all of those necks are always like, nope. And obviously iconic and, you know, I mean, a Strat is such a fantastic shape. It's, you know, one could argue it's the perfect guitar shape. But it's, you know, I wanted to do something a little different and something that was, had a different foundation. So I kind of consider myself kind of like a second generation vintage guy.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. Sort of.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so,
and at what point, I'm assuming at some point you got to visit a guitar factory workshop that wasn't just this local store that was doing all these mods for you.
Yeah, I actually got to visit the Jackson factory when it was in Ontario before a few years before Fender bought the company. I was, you know, just kind of in getting into, you know, internet forums and stuff. I was active participant of the Jackson Charvel forum. And, you know, I got to know some of the people that were there and, you know, that were collectors and maybe lived in, you know, nearby and knew the guys that worked there. And, I was out visiting in California, in like January of 2001 or 2002. And, you know, we went on a tour and, you know, Tim Wilson, which was, who was the shop manager, kind of the operations dude, back in the old days and still was up at that time. You know, just kind of took us around and seeing all these things and, you know, you see templates and, you know, all these huge machines and, you know, the paint room and you see people wet sanding. And, you know, I remember asking, you know, there's a guy that was, doing fret work on a Jackson Kelly and he was just like knocking off the fret ends, you know, rounding them off. And he was going so fast. And I was like, oh my God, how do you do that without just like driving that file like right into the fretboard? And it's because that's what he does all day. And, you know, I remember just, you know, talking with him for a little bit and just asking just dumb questions, you know, but it was very nice. And it was so cool. And, you know, I think we all can appreciate, you know, I think one of the reasons why videos of like shop tours and stuff like that are so popular is because I think we have a natural curiosity to see how things are made. Even if whether or not you're a fan of that brand or a fan of whatever that product is. I mean, there are, you know, TV shows, you know, here's, we're going to make chairs or we're going to make, you know, whatever. And it's, you stick around because there's a natural curiosity. But yeah, that Jackson factory, walking through that, you know, I have some photos of me in there. I'm like, oh my God, this is so cool.
And it was. Yeah. And where were you at that point in your career? Were you were starting to build custom guitars or you hadn't even tried that yet?
That was like parts guitar.
Okay.
Parts guitar time.
Okay.
And I remember as we were kind of wrapping up and we were in like the setup area, there was a guy named Greg who was their setup guy for many years. And I remember asking him, I'm like, well, where do you guys like set your string height? Like, you know, just kind of asking, you know, a lot of people would say, oh, you know, I kind of do it by feel. And I'm like, well, all right. But, you know, give me a framework. And so he told me, and that was like one of those moments too, where that was, you know, helpful, informative. And, you know, Greg and I keep in touch and he's with ESP now and he'll stop by at NAMM. And I'm like, dude, you're never going to remember this. But, you know, in 2002, I'm like, you know, how high do you set your strings? He's like, oh dude, I totally remember you because, you know, I was with other people that he knew and, you know, it was one of those things, I guess, but whether or not he actually remembers and I just like think he's just being very kind, but, it was one of those moments where it was just, okay, so this is very helpful and fuel for moving forward, something that small, you know?
So, what was the very first sort of original Sully guitar model?
The one that's completely like the one that I call my own, because, you know, like a lot of people, you start out making Strats and you slap your own logo on it.
Sure.
I always felt real cheesy doing that, but, you know, it's part of the process. The very first like that I will say is my design is a 71.
Okay.
And that is based on the classic American single cut. But that guitar kind of came to me, you know, 'cause going back to being real little and then, you know, wanting a Les Paul and then building a Les Paul only to have that turned upside down. I had owned a couple of them, and I never really understood why I never kept them. And this is not one of those, well, you got to play a bunch before you can get a good one kind of things. But so eventually I decided, and this was probably about 2007 or 2008, that I'm going to go and I'm going to find just like a Les Paul carcass on eBay, and I'm going to finish it out and fix it and make it, you know, make it my perfect Les Paul. And so I did that, and I filmed the whole process, and it's on YouTube, and it's kind of neat to see some of those old videos and see how things have changed. But I finished the guitar, and it was fine, but I finally realized, I'm like, oh, it's the scale length. Oh, that makes so much sense. Because like any guitar I ever had that was short scale, I never kept. And, you know, and it's because, you know, I think it's kind of like, you know, like the best pizza place is the one you grew up with.
Sure.
You know, like the guitar that I played the most was 25 and a half scale. So I like, okay, so that's the issue. And, you know, I'd like a little bit of a thinner neck and maybe, you know, a different radius fretboard. And although I don't mind a 12, and I use 12 inch radius pretty regularly. But so then I just started drawing, you know, cause I wanted some kind of a Les Paul thing, that had a 25 and a half scale, that wasn't a copy of a Les Paul, that had, that was more ergonomic, that didn't have a headstock that would snap if you looked at it funny. You know, things that, you know, not necessarily improvements per se, but things that I would like to have on the guitar if I'm going to design it. And I spent years on it. And it was one of those things where I would just kind of draw it and come back to it and make some, you know, more sketches. And then you finally get to that point where you're at analysis paralysis and you've got to just, you know, take the next step and make some templates. And then I made some templates. And then, you know, those body templates didn't quite look, you know, like, okay, yeah, it's kind of like the drawing, but I want to make some further tweaks and this, that, and the other thing. And then, so I, you know, I finally made one and then, you know, made a bunch more and then kind of, you know, refined it from there. But the 71 to me is, if that was the only guitar that I could build, for the remainder of, my life, I think I'd be okay with it.
And how far off was that original, Les Paul you butchered, from the finished 71 design?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, they're completely different guitars. Yeah. You know, people look at the 71 and, you know, I mean, I think we as guitar players, as a whole, and this is not any kind of profound statement, but are rather conservative in our tastes. And I've always tried to kind of work within someone's comfort zone and then add my own little thing to it. Cause when it all comes down to it, like we're all just making soup, you know, it's just, we're all using the same stuff. We're using, you know, for the most part, the same woods and the same ingredients. It's just, you know, this soup tastes a little different and this one is like this. So, you know, I don't necessarily want to, do something that's completely radical, that, you know, three people are going to like, or zero people are going to like. I like to kind of work within a comfort zone and maybe just kind of add some other stuff to it that might be a little different, but it's going to be okay. And it's been interesting, to watch how things go with that guitar as the awareness kind of increases, you know. I made the first one in 2013 and it made a couple more in like 2014, and now I think I've probably made more of that model, that one in the Raven, which is a take on, you know, which is like a Firebird style. However, going back to when I was saying it's like I'm a second generation vintage guy, this has nothing to do with the Gibson Firebird. My point of reference on a Firebird is a Jackson Firebird, mm-hmm. which they didn't make too many of them. But that like a Jackson Firebird is a completely different guitar. It's 25 and a half scale, doesn't neck dive. Oh, imagine that. And you know, I mean, to me, I think it's just a cooler guitar. But you know, I mean, you know, beauty in the eyes of the beholder and all that, it was, that spoke more to me. And so the Raven, gets its foundation in Jackson's version. And I was building them for a few years with a very similar body style. But then as like the 71 was kind of catching on a little bit more and was kind of, you know, continuing to refine what Sully guitars look like, I felt that I needed to change the body up a little bit and make it more where I want things to go. So like 71s and Ravens are my favorites of what I build. Yeah.
That was a really good answer. I'm sorry. No, are those your two most popular models?
They are. Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. 71s and Ravens. And then a Stardust, which is kind of a Stardust is an offset guitar for people who aren't necessarily fans of offset guitars. In that it's based on the Stardust is a 71 body, but it's kind of like drawn into quadrants, and some parts are flipped around and some things are shifted a little bit, you know, but it wanted to have kind of like a Jetsons kind of modern futuristic kind of style to it, you know, but you don't necessarily, you know, you can play any style of music on it. And that one is gaining some traction, but the most popular ones are definitely 71s and Ravens.
Yeah,
which I'm cool with.
I love the Stardust and the Raven as a guy who was kind of, frankly, as a teenager, intimidated by the world of metal, so I never really went down that avenue. Uh-huh. I love that they have they look badass, but they also look approachable from a guy who never owned an ESP, and so I appreciate that about those two.
You know, and thanks for saying that, because and I think that actually speaks to that's a good descriptor, I think, of me as a person in general, because while I grew up as a hair metal kid, I've learned over the years that, like, as a quote unquote metal guy, I'm not really much of a fan of the genre, which is kind of funny because, you know, I listened to, you know, I mean, a lot of stuff that was, you know, considered hair metal, like Motley Crue and, well, Ozzy wasn't hair metal, but like Motley Crue and Ozzy and Kiss and Aerosmith. And I loved the New York Dolls and, but I also loved Madonna and Duran Duran, and I loved Adam Ant, and I had a Stray Cat's birthday cake when I was 13. And, you know, like when we were at NAMM last year, the one regret that I had at NAMM, and this, I'm still really, really bummed out. Day one of NAMM, a friend of a friend of mine who was helping out at the booth, my buddy Adam, he was helping out at the booth. And Adam's friend is the bass tech for John Taylor of Duran Duran. And Duran Duran had like the best bass lines ever. And I loved Duran Duran so much. But like, you know, as a kid growing, especially as a guy growing up at that particular time, wasn't really something that you could, own and get away with. I remember I wore a Duran Duran t-shirt to my first day of seventh grade, and that did not go well. And so Adam's friend, day one of NAMM, within like the first couple hours, brought John Taylor to our booth specifically just to say hi. And I was doing a panel discussion at the Reverb booth at that time, and I was so bummed that I didn't get, if I could do it all over again. Oh, I think
I said screw Reverb and just kind of,
I thank you to Reverb for the opportunity, but man, if I could have been like 10 minutes late to go meet John Taylor, that would have been great.
Yeah.
So I may look a certain way, but I am pretty friendly and I am pretty approachable. And I think that the guitars that I build, while they are pointy, you could be in a metal band and play them. You could also not be in a metal band and play them. So I that matters more to me, because I want everybody to play a Sully guitar. I want everyone to own one, just because, you know, that works out for me.
Yes, it does. I mean, you also, not just to, you know, butter you up here, but like, you are a great communicator. There are very few luthiers, whether I'm talking across the board in terms of acoustic, flat tops, electrics, metal, whatever, who are as outgoing as you. And you've certainly never shied away from, you know, being on the forums or I watched a little bit on Sunday. You did a live Facebook thing, Breakfast with Sully. Is that a regular occurrence?
It is. Yeah. Saturday morning on the Facebook page. I do. I just have breakfast and I have zero. There's no preparation. And we just kind of talk about whatever.
Yeah. And it went on for like 90 minutes, it looked like.
Yeah, it probably should be a little bit shorter. But, you know, I used to co-host a podcast and it's kind of a similar, like the Breakfast with Sully stuff. It's kind of like the videos I used to do on the YouTube channel, which were not necessarily how to build a guitar, but it's more of along the lines of, this is what I'm doing. If you are interested in doing it, you probably can, because I mean, look at me. And here are some things that you probably want to think about. But you know, I do agree that a lot of you know, guitar builders and you know, other instrument crafters are maybe a little happier not dealing with the public.
Yeah.
I am not. I'm perfectly happy to do that. I've joked that I'm kind of like the Kardashian of guitar builders. I'm selfie friendly, and I will,
You'll marry Kanye.
Sure.
Sure.
Whatever you got to do.
Did that come, is that just your natural persona, or over the years, if you tried to teach people how to build parts casters or whatever, like did it kind of, evolve?
You know, I think it's probably something that I've always had in me. I am outgoing in a sense that I'm friendly and, you know, I'm happy to talk to people and that sort of thing, but I'm not like the mayor, you know, I'm not out going, shaking hands and all that stuff. When I started doing the videos and then classes, you know, to a certain extent, when I'm doing the videos or at NAMM or at a guitar show or having the interaction, I mean, it's me, but it's important to me to make sure that I'm kind of quote unquote on, for lack of a better term.
Yeah.
Just because I do recognize to a certain extent that I am somewhat of a marketable personality. So I feel very fortunate in that, because quite frankly, that's helped me a lot in networking, in meeting other people in the industry, in finding clients, because a lot of people are like, oh man, I watch your videos and you know, this, that, and the other thing. And if I wasn't doing them or if I was, you know, not trying to, you know, communicate and be friendly and you know, I think you know what I'm saying.
I do.
It's been very helpful. So I could probably feel as comfortable doing what I do or like hosting like weather forecasts on like a Spanish TV station.
Yeah.
I can't speak Spanish, but I can do the voice, and that's half the battle, I think.
Yeah, I think so. So what got you to Texas? When we last left you, you were raising your kid in Illinois, I believe.
Yeah, I have some family in Dallas, and I used to go and visit my Uncle Sully in the 90s and just for like little vacations. And it's geographically, Dallas is a very spread out city, and it looked not unlike where I lived in suburban Chicago. So there was that. It's also way cheaper to live here than up there. So, you know, cost of living is lower. People are probably a little more friendly. You know, the weather is, you know, I don't miss, things being too cold to drive, you know, I mean, yeah. It's just, yeah, I don't miss that. So, you know, I love the city, and it's very near and dear to my heart. And, I think I kind of wear that on my sleeve with some of the designs and some of the graphics that are done on various Sully guitars. The Chicago flag has been on there, on a few instruments and, you know, but I don't think I'm going to move back anytime soon.
God, Chicago has a flag. I didn't even know that.
course it does. Oh my goodness.
Seattle have a flag? I live here. I don't even know if we have a flag.
I would assume every kind of town, every kind of municipality or city and whatever has some sort of, I'm like, you've got a state flag. I'm sure there's a city flag.
Is it just like a skyline? What is it?
Well, now, while that alone would be gorgeous enough for a flag, no, the Chicago flag, it is so it's on a white background, and it's two light blue horizontal lines kind of on like the upper, you go down about 3 inches, you got a line, and then you go up from the bottom, you got 3 inches, you got another line. And then there are four 6-pointed red stars. And anybody that's a Chicagoan is going to roll their eyes at me because I know that those stars all signify something. I know one was for the World's Fair, but I don't remember what the other ones were. Okay. But yeah, it's pretty cool. It's not unlike the Washington D.C. flag. I think the Chicago flag might have been a little inspired by that. But it's also just a cool graphic. Looks good on a guitar. So
cool.
It's been on a few.
All right. I think the Seattle flag is just condo for lease and then an 800 number. But sans serif. To the point.
Yeah. It's just gray with maybe some drizzle.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. That was this big stereotype.
Actually sunny right now. So nice. where are you? Where is Sully Guitars at right now? Is it just you? Do you have helpers? Is this?
Yeah, it is for the most part just me.
Okay.
I do have someone. Some people. Well, I do have someone that does my paint work, I'm going to be adding a few more people to do that. But you know, I still work out of my garage. Let's see. I will build probably about 30 guitars this year of my own. There's the import line that will that's happening, and that's going pretty well.
And you can't just gloss over that. You have an import line already out of your house. What's the story there?
So, I think just with any kind of business, you got to look at how you're going to grow it. And I think that there is a certain romance that is associated with the grizzled craftsman who is, you know, always covered in sawdust and is wise and, you know, craggly and whatever. And that's not scalable, you know? Mm-hmm. Ever since I was a kid, like the first electric that I got, I took a Sharpie to the headstock and wrote Sully on it. So Sully Guitars has like always been a thing. I've always wanted to, anybody that's wanted to play a Sully guitar or own a Sully guitar, I want you to have one. I also understand that while I may be kind of in the middle to the shallow end of pricing, as far as the quote unquote boutique guitars go, it's a term, so I'm going to go with it. There are a lot of people that don't necessarily have $3,000 to throw on a guitar. I get it. So, one of my absolute best friends on the planet is a guy named Perry Ormsby. And Perry is a very, very successful guitar builder who lives in Perth, Australia. And, you know, Perry has been, we've known each other for, over 15 years, just from various, Randy Rhodes forums and stuff like that. And he, I think, single-handedly, as far as I'm concerned, has done a lot to dispel the myth of there's no money in building guitars. And, you know, we've all heard those jokes. They're like drummer jokes, you know. It's like, how do you make $1 million building guitars and start out with two? Oh, yeah. And it doesn't have to be that way. If you treat it like a business, you can make money doing it. You just have to treat it like a business. And I also understand that not all craftsmen are fantastic business managers.
Sure.
And I don't necessarily pretend to be either, but in our friendship, he really got me to get out of my own comfort zone and start doing classes, because he started doing classes, because it's a great way to make some money.
Yeah, it's like a mm-hmm. it's like a Ponzi scheme. You teach the next generation, he'll teach the next generation.
Yeah, sure. But it's also one of those things, like somebody asked me early on, like, aren't you afraid of training your competition? I'm like, hell no. This is, whatever. We're not, it's going to be good. I started doing classes, and I remember the first time he said, you should do classes. I'm like, oh man, I couldn't deal with that. Like people coming over and like in my garage. And he's like, yeah, just. Okay, fine. But I eventually started doing it. He's like, remember when you said that? I'm like, yeah, shut up. But so Perry has been very wildly successful with his own custom guitars. And a few years ago, he was contacted by a manufacturer in South Korea who makes guitars for a lot of the major manufacturers. And they do a great job. And so he started, an import production line, and we debuted them at NAMM 2016. And I say we because it was one of those things where NAMM registration was kind of going on, and he had messaged me, said, hey, if I go to NAMM and I he had 12 prototypes, if I go to NAMM with these prototypes for the production line and take the customs, would you want to bring some of your own guitars and, help me out. I'm like, yeah, duh, of course I would. And so we did, and it was a lot of fun. And so that's what we've done. We've always shared space at NAMM. And this year, the past 3 years, we would have a double booth. And, I'd have some of my stuff on a table, and he'd have his stuff on some tables. And it was a lot of fun. And this year for 2019, we are expanding the footprint so that he's going to have a double space and I'll have my own space. And it'll be an experience for me, and I'm looking forward to it. But it's one of these things where it's like, oh, I think this is going to be good. This could go either way, but it's going to be fine. When we would kind of wrap up NAMM each year, and off to various airports, and he said, I really want you to consider doing this, having a production line. From growing the business, it would be very good. And I was very resistant for a few reasons. And in 2017, throughout last year, I would kind of tease it on the on the Facebook page, and it would just be just to try and get a pulse check, because I knew that there was going to be a demographic that was going to be very against the idea just because they view it as selling out or something disingenuous or just lame or whatever, and that's fine, and I accept that feedback, but a lot of those people that were saying that aren't actually my customers to begin with.
Yeah.
So there's that, but I'm trying to figure out, the best way to make this happen. And, I can look at Jackson as an example, because when, I remember in the early 90s, the Japanese Jacksons had a lot of the same things that the US custom guitars did. They had pearl shark fins, they had binding around the fretboards and headstocks, and they had, this, that, and the other. They were kind of competing with each other. But the price point was, much different, and so they kind of, retooled some things, and I had to figure out what the import guitars were going to look like, because I don't want them to look just like the guitars that I build here, because sure. If I'm going to spend $2,700 on a custom guitar, why would I pay extra just because you sweated on this in your garage? I mean, trust me. I mean, my sweat might be cool, or I don't even think it is, but it's definitely not worth, that much more. And so I kind of had to figure out what this was going to look like, much like, as I kind of figure out and discontinued models over the years, figuring out what Sully Guitars looks like as a brand and as what the product offering is. And then you got to come up with names and that sort of thing. And so there is, there is the Sully Guitars conspiracy series, which I thought was just fun wordplay. You know, you can absolutely tell from a visual standpoint the difference between one of the production guitars and a custom. Right now, I'm making very hard lines between what will and won't go on, you know, the production guitars. Like there's no binding. I'm not doing figured tops. I'll do sparkle because that's fun. But they'll still have compound radiuses. They'll still have stainless steel frets. They'll still have hip shot hardware. And you know, pickups that are made to my own kind of recipes. So they are very much, you know, I'm providing all of the CAD files and, you know, so it is a thing. I had some of the prototypes at NAMM last year and, after NAMM was done and, the dust settled, we did, you know, the pre-orders for run one and I made two models available. One is the Stardust that we were talking about before. And, the other model for run one was the Conspiracy Series version of the 71, which was based on the very first 71 that I ever built just so I could build it and make it a thing. And it's a flat top. It's a flat top body. It's got a cool kind of forearm bevel that I think complements the design. It's got a lot of the same contours in the neck joints and it's comfy. But you know, it's kind of, you know, I guess you could say stripped to its essence, but yeah. It's not a guitar that looks like it's made by a 9-year old in an Asian country. They're pretty good.
And what are you selling them for?
So Stardusts are like $1,099.
Wow.
And 71s are $1,199. It's a set neck guitar. Stardusts are bolt on. They've all got, you know, laminated necks. They're like the Stardusts are 3-piece maple. Whereas the 71s are 3-piece mahogany because those are mahogany bodied guitars. And so run one, it's in production right now. I got some you know, progress photos, and we all love that sort of thing. I love sending them to my clients, and I love getting them from when, you know, my paint guys are, you know, doing something. I'm like, oh, send me a picture. I'm like, oh, that looks so cool. And you know, so run one is happening right now and will land later this summer along with the prototypes for pretty much the remaining product line. So there will be Ravens, there will be a 624 and a 624T, which is like a Super Strat, Super Tele kind of thing. And the Alita, which is a redesigned version of kind of like an Explorer shape. So I'm really excited to see for these things to show up, because this is another one of those things where, you know, as I mentioned, when, you know, doing classes helped me kind of quit a day job, kind of helped me look at it as, you know, a business and how to make things scalable. The Conspiracy Series, I think, is just another kind of step along that path of scalability and having something that's sustainable. And to the people that have been maybe not super supportive of the idea, which thankfully it's the minority of people.
They weren't your customers anyways.
Well, there's that, but I also tell them, and this is very important for me to make clear to people, is that the Conspiracy Series in no way is a replacement of anything.
Yeah.
It's just an addition to, you know, there's also going to be, and I've been working on this throughout the year, and there will be like a US standard series that I'm still going to be making, but a lot of that stuff is going to be CNC'd, which is, that's another thing, another step in making things scalable, because, you know, I want to make more than, you know, 30 guitars next year.
Yeah.
And, you know, this, that, and the other thing. So it's kind of like, you know, there'll be three tiers. I'll have the production line, which will be, you know, generally as it grows, like under 1500, the standard series. And that's just going to be kind of, somebody wants a Raven. Or if I think of a Raven, I'm like, okay, this is what it looks like in my mind. It's like, imagine the color orange. You're seeing the color orange. It's the same kind of thing. To me, a Raven is, you know, a couple of humbuckers. It's got this bridge. It's got, you know, this, that, and the other thing, and these inlays, and, you know, this, that. So we'll do a standard series that might drop the pricing down a little bit, and which I think will be helpful. And then the custom stuff, you know, if you want a 71 Trella, but you want different inlays, and if I agree to that, because I'm a little... I'm a little
fight back.
That guitar. I say no to a lot of stuff.
Oh, cool.
I say no to tons of stuff. I probably say no to more things than I say yes to. And I'm a believer of saying yes to life and experiences. But
what's the most mundane thing that you said no to where afterwards you're being like, I'm just being a dick?
You know, let me try and think of something. There are a couple of lines in the sand. There's definitely one line in the sand that I will never, ever, under any circumstances whatsoever, say yes to. And I realize it's a little dickly, but I also don't care. I will not, under any circumstances, put a Bigsby on any of my guitars ever. And some of the guitars that I like, when I've done redesigns, like with the Raven, you've got the elevated, like the raised elevation that tapers in a manner that you can't fit one on.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure, you know, anyway, I hate them so much. Hate them, absolutely hate them. So that is one of my old man on the lawn kind of things.
Perfect.
One of my regular customers, a guy named Pat, and he's taken build classes. I've built him a few guitars now, and you know, he'll spec stuff, and he knows that I say no to a lot of things, and he's like, okay, you're gonna get on the lawn, but you know, what about this? And there may have been things that I might have been resistant to, but were kind of like, well, all right, if I do it for a friend, then I should do it for you, and it looked okay, or oh, that's okay, yeah, that works, but I can't. I'm a little irritated that I can't think of an exact example, but I mean, there have certainly been guitars that I'm like, yeah, I don't really know about this spec wise, but yeah. Then you know, you go through it, and I'm like, oh yeah, that's kind of cool.
Yeah. So how do you figure? I mean, I imagine, at least at first, the conspiracy series, is going to be relatively low production runs, but made in South Korea. Do you have to figure out, like, did you have to figure out months ago, like, okay, I think we'll need 20 reds and 30 blacks, and, you know, like, did you have to figure out what you're actually ordering from them ahead of time?
Sure.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So, you know, I've got another very talented person who helps out both Perry and I, a guy named Beto. And Beto is a great photographer, and he's also got some pretty serious Photoshop guitar mock-up skills.
Okay.
So just like when you're, you know, if you're watching like House Hunters and you see people that walk through a house and it's perfectly staged, but they're like, I don't know about that wall color. And it's like, dude, you're going to paint, you know, but if people can't see their own stuff and stuff. So if I post a progress photo of an unfinished guitar, the majority of people don't see what the final project is and product is. And that's okay. So, Beto put together a bunch of, mock-ups, and before I pulled the trigger and had the prototypes made, I had to figure out what these things were going to look like. So I would use social media as best as I possibly could. And I would put this, like two mocked up guitars next to each other. And it'd be like, you know, you like the one on the left or the one on the right better. And that would kind of help me refine things. But you also have to take into consideration that people that participate in internet polls are not necessarily buying the final product. So take that into consideration, but build it mostly the way you want it to look. So once I figured out the final colors for run one, we had the mock-ups done. And so, you know, we kind of let people loose and pre-order things. And then based on the pre-orders, I ordered additional numbers. So if, you know, Plum Crazy was a really popular color for the 71 Starlings, so I ordered extras of that than, say, like a plain black one. So yeah, it's a little bit of both, but yeah. And so right now I'm kind of going through this process of what are the colors that I'm going to use for, you know, the other models. And I'm going to do my best to make it as standardized as possible, because not doing that will drive you crazy along with the people that you work with crazy. Yeah, I'm kind of going through that now, because, you know, run two pre-orders for the other models are going to be opening, you know, probably in early July. So I've got to get that kind of sorted. But once I have the prototypes here, that will certainly help, because it's, you know, going from a mock-up, it's helpful, but it's not the final guitar. And you know, I'm usually pretty good at kind of, you know, seeing what the final product is going to look like. But, you know, you do have, you got to make room for those pleasant surprises.
And then do you touch the guitars when they come back from South Korea before they hit customers, or are they pretty much ready to go?
Yeah. Well, a little bit of both. So when the prototypes that I took to NAMM arrived, I was really, and I shouldn't have been. And this is one of these, you know, country of origin biases, which is, you know, whatever, they are what they are. But I was expecting that, oh, this factory that makes 7,000 guitars a month, they do, you know, oh, well, they can't possibly, you know, I'm going to have to do all this stuff. I'm like, oh my God, dude, get over yourself. So these guitars showed up, and the only things that I needed to do to them was swap the pickups. And that actually was planned anyway, because in order to get the guitars completed and to me in enough time to get them to NAMM, we just, you know, Perry Ormsby, just, he had a bunch of, he had just enough standard humbuckers just to send to them, just to put in the guitars. Mm-hmm. So they were shipping with those guitars, and then I just swapped the pickups out. The frets were great. I know that I did a little bit of fretboard cleanup, but, you know, maybe turn a truss rod, play them. They're really solid. And that was a really good feeling. One of the guys, that plays my guitar is a guy named Stevie D, and he's a guitar player for Buck Cherry. And Stevie has a signature model in the Conspiracy series. And, it's a 71 Starling, and it's flat black, and it's got a gloss black Chicago flag graphic on it. Stevie's also from Chicago. And, he got that guitar at NAMM. The only thing I did was put the pickups that I use, which Grover Jackson makes them, and I get them from Grover, and they're really, really good pickups. I just swapped the pickups. Stevie played it at NAMM. He's on tour with that guitar right now. Got it. And this thing's a tank. I love this guitar. And so they're pretty good. Now, it's not to say that, you know, I'm going to have a rather large batch of guitars showing up this summer, and I'm going to have to figure out where they're all going to go, but that's a fun problem. And it's not to say that, you know, I expect that there will probably be some shipping damage here and there. There might be a dent. But I am going to go through each and every one of those guitars and make sure that they're good to go, you know, before they do.
Yeah. And how, I don't know that anybody's ever figured out the magic formula for this, but how are you, where in your business plan are you figuring out, like, these I'm selling direct, you're at NAMM, so obviously you're kind of sort of looking for dealers?
Sure. Yeah.
How do you figure out the split there?
Well, I mean, that's, you know, I'm fortunate enough that I have friends who also have dealers, and, you know, ask a friend, hey, you know, so what's industry standard as far as, you know, dealer discounts and that sort of thing. And it's like, well, it's this for customs, and for the production line, it's here. And, you know, I have some really, really great dealers that I work with, and have for a few years, that have been helpful with that too. And, so, you know, we got that sorted, and, the dealers got to, you know, pre-order some guitars, but, you know, we're all going to, no one's undercutting anyone. And I think we're all going to be able to continue to coexist beautifully.
And are you still anticipating selling a bunch direct as well?
Sure. Yeah. Okay. I mean, I'll sell direct. I also love the idea of working with brick and mortar stores, because, invariably I'm always asked, well, I'm in your city here, where can I play one of your guitars? And I hate saying,
nowhere.
You can't. Yeah. So, you know, but there's demo videos online. Yeah. Cause that helps, but, I guess it does, but you know, I mean, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it's especially for my international customers, it's, beneficial to work with a distributor and dealers overseas, to help get, you know, that market satisfied. And, we'll continue to do that. You know, but it's, I'm also kind of, I don't have to make this decision now, so I'm not going to make this decision now, but there may be a point in time where I'm going to have to adopt one model or the other, as far as, you know, going the dealer model and distribution or your direct, or maybe not. Maybe they will continue to coexist and be fine. So we'll see.
Exciting we'll see. Times. Yeah.
You know, I mean, yeah, it could be. And, you know, I often joke with people like, oh, well, what's the worst thing that could happen? And, you know, the thing, and I'm thinking about, you know, with doing this, it's done in a manner that, you know, it's not like I didn't have to buy 1,000 guitars and I have to try and sell them out of the trunk of my car, you know, and it's kind of worst case scenario. I bought a bunch of guitars that I'll be able to sell. So, you know, I mean, it's going to be all right. It's not, you know, it'll be okay.
All right. Cool.
Yeah. Good times.
Sully, thanks for talking to us. You'll be happy to know our electric issue has a Grover Jackson feature in it. So we're working on an electric guitar kind of annual, our inaugural electric guitar annual. So
I am really excited about that. I Chelsea Clark had posted that she had contributed to that, and so I was really
leak. Yeah, our first really leak from the issue.
Oh, wow. Well. I was really excited. I was a little bummed that I didn't get to write some too, but that's okay.
Right.
I'm perfectly happy to have anybody help spread the magic of that is Grover Jackson, you know. And it's one thing we didn't really get to talk about is that, and this was like a huge thrill a couple of years ago, Grover and I built a batch of 20 71 Trellas, which is the kind of my flagship model. And that was great. You know, I went out there, we made the test guitars, and, you know, they built the guitars, and then they came to me, and then I did, you know, frets, wiring, and all that stuff, and then sent them out, and we had certificates of authenticity and all that stuff. And it's so cool to see Jackson sign his, you know, Grover sign his name, because like, oh, there's the logo, you know.
Yeah.
And it was quite a thrill. And it's, I am very, very, very fortunate to have him in my life. Oh. So he should be in everyone's life. So read that and enjoy that article. And I'm glad that there is an electric feature coming soon.
Yeah. All right, man. Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
You have an open invite to join us again.
Ah, thanks.
This was fun.
I appreciate it.
Sure.
Thank you to those who got through this issue or episode or whatever it is. Thanks.
If you enjoyed this podcast, if you like what we are up to, please, please, please give us a 5-star review over on iTunes. It takes about 20 seconds of your time, and it helps us out with our search rankings. Till next week, thanks, everybody.